Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 291 of the Board Game Barbecue podcast, sponsored by Advent Games. I'm your host, Dana Banana, and today I'm joined by another member of the Brisbane crew, Def. How are you, Def?
I'm very well, Dana. Thank you. How are you doing?
Well, thanks. And I'm also joined by Lauren from Sydney. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, mate. Someone's got to keep Brisbane in check, so...
Good luck with that today.
Try my best. Good luck.
It's been quite a while since I think I've talked about any games on a podcast. I think it's been 2 months.
Too busy living the life, traveling the world.
I couldn't help it. So I'm feeling, I don't know if you guys feel this way, but I feel backed up. Do you ever feel like that? You know, like when you haven't talked about a game for a while, like you haven't talked about games for a while.
You've got to clarify what you mean by backed up.
Def, are you backed up?
I feel like I'm missing the joke here as a non-native English speaker, so I'm going to steer clear of that one.
Oh, well, I just feel like been playing games, but I haven't been able to talk about them. So I've got a lot of, I don't know, board game juice or something.
Oh, my goodness.
Something. I don't know. Anyway, never mind.
But, Dana, you've been living the high life, traveling Jaipur and Jaipur.
I have, and that was such a thrill, actually. I was traveling with my mum and my 18-year-old son, who was having a bit of a gap period after finishing school, and it was actually lovely in our hotel to be able to set up Jaipur and to be able to teach it and have Jaipur in the back, like through the window, looking through our window at the view. And you could see, because it's very built up and messy, and you could just see like little concrete blocks and everybody going about their daily lives and what they were doing. And it was quite fascinating. It was a really wonderful experience. So I don't know if I mentioned the country, but anyway, it was in India. So yes, I have been living the high life. It was quite amazing. And the people That's were great. Lovely. So yeah.
Sounds like it might be time for a travel podcast spin-off.
I could talk about travel, and I know Lauren could. And you too as well. You've got a travel thingy.
Community, yeah.
Yes, you've got a travel community. We could start like our own travel agent.
Do it right now. Welcome to the first episode.
Oh, no. That was crazy.
So while I've been away, you guys have been playing games together.
Not enough, like Lauren said.
I could never get enough of games with you. Do you want to start us off with actual board game conversation and what you and I have been playing together then?
Yeah, so we had a game of, well... We have a few games of Dracula versus Van Helsing where I think, you know, after that first time we played it, it was so close and, you know, we kind of thought maybe it's just us not knowing the game very well. And then every subsequent game after that was down to the last bite or down to the last card, if you like. So, yeah, I think I've mentioned this game before. We played it on Board Game Arena. I don't know if you can actually get a copy of this, if it's been released or if it's available in... It's definitely not available in Australia. Yeah, so I'm not quite sure what the deal with that is, but it's basically a simple... would you call it trick-taking or bluffing? It's not trick-taking.
It's a tableau hand management.
Yeah,
hand management. Tactical card play game? Yeah.
Where you have like 5 cards in your hand, but you have them in order. And I'm assuming on the table you'd have some kind of stand and you put them one by one next to each other, because in front of you, the second player has the similar situation, but in front of both of you, there's this board with 5 simple regions, and each region corresponds to the same card for both players. So the first region corresponds to the first card that you've got. And so... players draw a card from a deck, and then you can decide which of the cards that you have or the card you drew to discard. But when you discard the card, you resolve the card's effect. Now, the cards are only numbered 2-7 or 1-7, 1-8. And there's four suits. That's it. That's 32 cards. And the higher the value of the card, the stronger the effect is. But if you discard the high number card, that means that you end up with a smaller value card most of the time. And when the round finishes, the game sort of instructs you to reveal the hands, and then the hands are compared, and whoever wins each territory gets essentially a point. Dracula gets to bite one of the citizens in that region, one of the four citizens, and Van Helsing deals one damage to the Dracula. So you balance making these decisions about which cards to keep, but at the same time having weak effects or even negative effects if you discard low-value cards. It's just such a fast-paced, great decision space, simple game with such a small number of components. I think it's absolutely brilliant. I've had great fun playing this. I wish we could play it more on the table at some point, if it ever gets released, actually.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, this game's a hoot. Always down to the wire. The art's super charming, and the theme really comes through, I think, weirdly, for such a simple game.
Hmm.
Is it like if you play Dracula or Van Helsing, is it fairly evenly matched in that way, or it doesn't matter?
Yeah, they have different objectives. So there's four citizens in every region. So Dracula wins immediately. The game ends immediately if Dracula manages to bite four people in the same region and turn them into zombies or vampires or whatever. Or if he manages to survive five rounds and not get killed. And Van Helsing has to win, he has to kill the Dracula. So he has to deal, I think, 12 damage it is, or 15, I can't remember now, to Dracula. And at the same time, he has to manage the different regions of the map to not allow Dracula to reach four bites, four vampires there. But we felt like, I think we've played both sides now, have we? And it seems to be fairly challenging on both sides. It doesn't sound like it. We haven't seen the game being sort of heavily unbalanced towards one side or easier for one of the two characters. I don't know.
It's pretty amazing when you think about it that we can play these games on BGA before we can, I mean, but so long before we can ever get our hands on a physical copy.
Yeah, it's proved as a really good marketing strategy. I mean, for Forest Shuffle, how many people were playing that like crazy before they were able to get a physical copy?
Yes, yep. Nah is another one where people, you know, we can't get that in Australia. It's for pre-order, but who knows when that's coming, and people are playing that. I think it's nominated for an upcoming award. So, yeah, it's been amazing, BGA, and the types of games that are coming onto there now. It's wonderful.
The second game I wanted to very quickly touch on is a game that I've recently played after quite a bit of time. And this time, first time, my oldest daughter joined Demi and I, my partner and I, to a game. And that's Five Tribes. And it's just such a, I would almost consider it a classic game now, like a classic design. And it's very, it's quite timeless. The mechanic is, you know, very straightforward. The rules are not that hard, you know, and every move players make impacts the board state so much that you almost have to consider it like a tactical reactive game rather than, you know, you can't really plan for what's going on. It's a bit of friendly chaos. So yeah, Five Tribes, I don't know if you guys have played it, but it's such a great game. I think if, you know, I have had to make a list of games that would have to be in every collection, that, you know, Five Tribes would probably be in the considerations for that.
I would agree with that. And I love that Mancala type mechanic where you're dropping off your meeples in different spots to get to somewhere. I love it, and I agree it's a classic. And funnily enough, I'm in the process of organising and trimming down my collection, and I'm not joking. I was looking at Five Tribes. I opened the box and I thought, nah, can't get rid of it. put the box lid back on and put it back again, because it is such a classic. Yeah.
Have you played it, Lauren?
Yeah, I agree with Dana. It's been on the chopping block a few times, and then I play it again, and I go, gosh, this game is really good. It has to go back.
Yeah.
But you just kind of forget how good it is. It came up in our recent Patreon trivia. It's the second highest rated game from Days of Wonder on Board Game Geek.
Exceptionally
popular, this game.
It did come up in trivia. That's right. What was the number one game, by the way, out of interest?
It's Heat.
Heat, yes.
It's in like the top 50 now. On
already? Wow.
Really?
Okay.
Just
that has shot flown through the
up. Blew up there. Yeah.
Yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah, no, Five Tribes, excellent. I've not played with any of the expansion content.
Me neither.
But the base game is so good.
I didn't even know there's an expansion. Base game
is two. There's two expansions.
Okay.
So, but for the amount of times that I actually play it, I don't believe that I need it. But it's fantastic. And Lauren, I'm very excited to hear about your game. I have been toying up whether I should get this or not, and I can't wait to hear about your experience with the next one.
I got the chance to play the bonus box for Micro Macro Crime City. So for anyone who doesn't know, Micro Macro Crime City, it's in my top 10. I just think it's one of the most innovative, brilliant ideas, games to come out in recent memory. But there are four maps which have different crimes, but if you put them in a grid, they form one giant map. And recently they released the bonus box, which not only has additional cases for each of the four core boxes, it also comes with three what it calls epic cases.
Wait, it has additional cases from the already released boxes?
Yes.
Oh, wow. So they either had those planned in advance, or the art is so evocative of creating its own stories that they went back and said, hey, what else what other stories can we create based on the existing art?
100%. We had a long conversation about how far into the design process Johannes had figured out that he wanted to have multiple maps and multiple cases. Not really sure, but you're right. At the very least, the art would lend itself to that. But you get these, in addition to these bonus cases, you get three epic cases. And the epic cases are split up into chapters and they require multiple maps. I will say on the offset, for anyone who's concerned that they don't have the table space to have four of these giant maps laid out at once, don't fret, because in the chapters it directs you, you know, now get the map for Showdown, now get the map for Full House, now get the map for the original.
Do you have to put them all out? Don't you have to join them all together, like all at once?
So we didn't have to. I thought originally that we would have to join them all together at once. And I sent you guys a photo of us all hunched over on the floor before our backs gave out in the first 10 minutes of playing.
Yeah.
But you don't have to. You can have one map on the table and then kind of one off to the side. As long as you know where they join, and the bonus box comes with a little key, it shows you where they join. You basically only need to refer to that one map, and then once it gives you a second, you're then referring to those two. But you're mostly referring to the second while kind of jumping back and forth. So you don't really need to have all four laid out in one big contiguous square. So if space is a consideration, that's not going to be a barrier, because what we ended up doing was having one map and then, okay, now let's put the next one on top. Oh, we need to have a look. Let's go back to this one. But it was mostly just one map at a time. These epic cases, if you don't like the original Micro Macro, not going to change your opinion. In fact, I would argue you really have to like Micro Macro Crime City to enjoy the epic cases, because it changes it from an opening or an appetizer to really the main event. They are very long and involved cases. We spent a very long time playing this epic case, and we had a blast, because you have to make bigger leaps in logic. And I kind of don't want to tell you the content because it would be too easy to go into spoiler territory, but you have to make assumptions about their relationships. You have to make assumptions about motives and ideas in a way that it's a little more creative and a little more cerebral than the regular cases. I loved it a lot. It was really fun. And the best part about poring over these maps is like what you were saying, Def, with these details. So it was the four of us. It was myself and my partner and then my brother and his wife. And my brother and his wife or whoever would be looking at the main case. And then all of a sudden you kind of notice this one character and you might laugh about their appearance. Like Scott, it was called Ponytail Guy. And then about 5-10 minutes later, we're like, oh my gosh, there's Ponytail Guy. And he's like dragging a dead body. And you go, what are you doing? And so they're off doing the case. But I've just been sidetracked with the narrative of this totally unrelated character because we've seen him crop up in a few places. Great.
That's awesome.
I just really, really enjoyed the bonus box. If you like the cases, you like the game, I definitely think they're worth a shot. But it will be the main event for your game evening.
Is the bonus box, is that sort of, you know, an adults only thing, or is that for children? Or
it could be for families. It does come with a guide as well about family ratings, which they instigated from, I think, Full House onwards, so the second one, because it was a complaint of the original.
Yes.
But so there are family ratings for cases. It's kind of similar to the previous ones where there's some, I would say, adult themes, but because it's portrayed in such a whimsical way, I don't think there is a problem with kids playing this game and families playing these games, because I think that even though it's about murder and infidelity and there are kind of things that are theoretically really adult themes laid on top of it, it's very superficial with how it touches on those themes and how it portrays them visually. So I don't ever feel like it's too much for families. And if you do feel that way, the games now do a really good job of filtering out themes by cases so you can choose which cases are going to be appropriate for your family and not, and there's enough content on there.
Mm. I just love the idea about those types of games as well, that you can pass them on to other families and then they can enjoy the experiences and then you get to talk about it at the end. I love that kind of thing.
Absolutely. I want to frame them and put them up in my house as interactive art. I just think they're the coolest things.
Oh, they would be a talking point. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I can't speak highly enough about the bonus box. 10 out of 10 recommend.
Okay. Well, I've been playing Skyrockets. Not sure if you've heard about this game or not, but this is from Let's Play Games.
Yep.
And it's published by Floodgate Games. And if any of you are familiar with Kites, have you played Kites before?
Heard of it, know the premise, but never played it.
Mm. So in Skyrockets, it's a similar theme to Kites, where you've got several sand timers of all varying times, say from 30 seconds to over a minute. They all vary. They're all different colours. And in your group, you're playing cards to try and flip these timers. So it's a real time game. And so as you can imagine, it's short, but it's chaotic fun. And so you're playing these cards. And the idea with Skyrockets is there's an orange timer. And each time that orange timer runs out, you turn it over and move it to this next spot in a grid, and you're trying to move it, I think it's four times until it gets to its end location. And once it's run out and none of the other timers have run out, and you haven't used any of your lives, I'll say, then you win that challenge and you can move on to the next one. Now, this game will be compared directly to Kites because it's almost the same type of thing. Kites came out first, I think, in 2021, 2022. And Kites is, it's still got the same mechanic where you're trying to play cards cooperatively to keep these sand timers from running out. But if a sand timer does run out with Kites, that's sort of the end. You've basically got to start again. There's a few additional cards that you can add in as well, which stop you from talking for a round or things like that. But the base game is really just you've got to get through the entire deck of cards without these sand timers running out. Skyrockets just adds a few little things which I think make it a little bit more appealing. So I think if you didn't have kites, you wouldn't buy kites over Skyrockets. It's a better version, I believe. So one reason is that you do get three lives in kites. Sometimes, especially if you're playing with families, it can be over in like 10 seconds and then you're sort of having to restart and redo things again, and it can get a little frustrating. I'd imagine if you're playing with family or maybe younger family members, that could get a little bit frustrating with kites. Mm-hmm. But Skyrockets, you get three lives. And the theme is that you're meant to be putting on this wonderful show, wonderful fireworks show, and if a sand timer runs out, you just turn it over, but you get to turn over one tile. And you, if you do that three times, then the round is over. Then you've lost. The other thing is it comes with a challenge book with 30 challenges. And they're really interesting. Like, it might have a blind deck of cards that you have to play rather than playing the cards in your hand before you can win. Sometimes sand timers get stacked on top of each other. Or maybe you might have it where certain players in your team can see the sand timers, but you can't, and you're having to direct them which cards to play. So it gives you lots of challenges, and I think I really like that idea because it gives you a sense of accomplishment when you're going through that, and you could do them in any order. It doesn't really matter. So I sort of prefer that. I think if I had something like kites, I might get a bit bored with it over a period of time. I did play it with my family and they really liked Skyrockets. So I would definitely, if you haven't got kites, I think it's definitely the one to get.
Very good.
I don't know if you guys, do you guys get turned off by real-time games when you see that, when you see real-time, does that turn you on?
I do. I do because I've never played a game that was real, but based on real time mechanic, and enjoyed it. So I've played, for instance, Rival Restaurants quite a few times, and it's just chaotic to the point where we just ignore the real time aspect and just, you know, take the actions we gotta take. So I haven't had a good experience. I'm sure there's games that do it better, but yeah, it's not something that attracts me at all.
I have only played a few real-time games, so I feel like I can't speak too much on the genre. But the few that I have played, I've tended to rate higher. Jetpack Joyride's a good example of that. I actually found that game really fun, but most people rate it as a very kind of middling game. And the same with Escape the Cursed Temple. I also find really kind of quite chaotic fun, but I just, not played many of them, I think because they're just really hard to table. People really seem to enjoy Fit to Print, though.
I love Fit to Print. I love that game. Oh, my God. I love that game. And that is brilliant. And everybody I've taught it to loves that game. I'd actually forgotten about Fit to Print in terms of real-time games. So that's definitely a highlight.
I think definitely I just want to try more of them, I think. But would you say that they're hard to table, Dana? You got to convince people more?
Yes. A lot of people just go, oh, I don't really like it. But look, one challenge of Skyrockets goes for 10 minutes. So it's not that difficult. It's a short play time. So perhaps Fit to Print, for example, is much longer, of course. So I think something like Skyrockets would be fairly simple to get people to play. The other game I've been playing, or I've played a few times now, is Bark Avenue, and this is also from Let's Play Games, and it was published by Good Games and another company called Terra Dice Games, which I was looking up, is the company from started by the designers. It's a married couple, actually, who live in New York.
Huh.
And so this game is about being competitive dog walkers in New York City.
Love it.
Yeah, and it's essentially a pick-up-and-deliver game. So, and whoever earns the most money is the winner. And the main arc of the game is that you roll a die to see if your dog poops. And there's even a golden nugget poop. So pooping in this game is really good. So I was playing it with my husband yesterday, and as soon as we rolled the die and we got the poop, we'd all go, poop. So, you know, it's quite, yeah, it can be quite funny in that way. And my kids like that, and they're teenagers, and we still, I mean, how can you not laugh at poop? It's like farting. You're going to laugh at it. And so, yes, and then you can move, do one action, which is generally picking up a dog or dropping off a dog, or you can make sure it does its favorite activity, which is like throwing a ball or going to the park or going on a sniffing adventure. And then it passes to the next player, and that's basically your turn. I actually really enjoy the theme of this game. Some of the dogs are foster dogs, and they score sort of, not score, but you can do additional things with foster dogs to try and encourage you to take those dogs for a walk. And I really love it in the rule book that the foster dogs are actually real dogs, and it's got a little bio of the dogs and the foster organization that has been looking after them. So I really enjoyed that. And, you know, some of the stories I guess can be quite sad, because some dogs have been in foster care for 4 years, you know, so it's a long time. So I'm hoping that perhaps this game, those dogs were adopted by people. But I really love it that they have used real dogs in the game. One thing I will say is that, and I don't know if you find this about pick up and deliver games, but I would just say that pick up and deliver generally can be repetitive. I don't know if you've played any other pick up and deliver games, but because you're just, that's part of the game. That's the whole game, is picking up, in this case, picking up dogs, dropping them off, picking them up, dropping them off, and just trying to make your travel, you know, the most optimal way to go, sort of thing. But each time you're still picking up and dropping off dogs. And I don't know if you guys find that mechanic can be a little bit repetitive, but I find that. So this game goes for 17 rounds.
Right.
So it's a lot. And I did find that, you know, sort of as I was playing with my husband yesterday, you know, by three quarters or two thirds, three quarters of the way through the game, it was sort of like, okay, look, we need to finish this up, you know, sort of thing. And we ended up finishing it early. So that's probably my main gripe with the game. That's not a difficult thing to do, though. There are so many rounds, it's not hard to cut out some of them with some house rules. So I don't really have a problem with that. But, yeah, I just found with this, I don't know whether it's just that mechanic, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I played this one too, and I had a kind of similar feeling about it. I felt like,
yeah,
I kind of already had in mind at the beginning of the walk, all right, I'm going to go there, 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 and there.
Yeah.
And it felt like every one of my turns I'd already made that decision just like that. And I was just going through the motions a bit in this game.
Yes. Yes.
It's very accessible. The art is exceptionally charming. And I agree with you. It would be very easy to house rule to make it shorter so it fit more in terms of game length with the kind of target market that it's trying to strike.
Correct. Actually, I must say this. On the box, it says 15 minutes per player. That cannot possibly be right.
Oh, those things are always a lie.
But that's way off. It's longer. It's definitely longer than that. So we probably, my husband and I, it was probably an hour and a half, something like that. It was probably an hour and a half. Yeah, you'd just be advised that it doesn't go, it's not 15 minutes per player. But it is, I agree with you, it's very accessible. It's sort of gateway-ish family level game. So people who love dogs would love it. And I certainly prefer it to Dog Park. I didn't particularly gel with Dog Park, so I prefer it to that. So, yeah, so that's Bark Avenue. And I'm just going to quickly mention one other game. I've only played it once, but I think I might have to sizzle this. And this is just right up my alley. And actually we played it, I think, I'm not sure whether you played it, Lauren, when we were at Adrian's place in our Gamerpalooza. Let's Go to Japan. Were you playing that?
Seen it, played. It looks beautiful, but I've not played it.
Oh, my God, it's beautiful. Of course it's beautiful. The Kickstarter came wrapped in this Japanese cloth. There's a name for it. I can't remember what it is, but this special Japanese cloth, and you could get these bowls, completely unnecessary, of course, but, you know, they seduced me. And, yeah, I really enjoyed this game, and I thought I'd just briefly mention it because I can feel a sizzle coming on with this game. Where you're just planning your itinerary, you're planning your holiday for a week, and then you get to go on the holiday and whoever has the most points at the end wins, but it's simultaneous play, it's card drafting, and it's beautiful to boot. So I'm looking forward to a few more plays before I actually get to talk about it. So, yeah, that's Let's Go to Japan by AEG, I believe. So just a few announcements. It is awards season. It's like the board gaming Oscars.
I will pull a Ricky Gervais here and say this is useless. There's no need for any of these to take 6 weeks and hundreds of people nominating and voting. All this show should be about is we just give the award to Voidful and Danza. Congratulations, Voidful. You win everything. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
We're going to be talking about the nominations later, and I saw Voidful and I thought, here we go. This is going to be another sizzle about Voidful.
Truly the Netflix of board games for it's
yeah.
here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we're starting with the 4th Annual Board Game Barbecue Awards. So we're celebrating the best games of 2023. The nominations will commence on Wednesday, the 1st of May. So that's the day after this episode drops. Nominations are open to any member of the Board Game Barbecue community. So that includes Facebook, Instagram, Twitter and Discord. And that's where you'll find a link to the nomination form. And you can nominate in any of the 8 categories. You don't have to nominate all of them. You could just nominate one for one category. So it's very flexible. And there's going to be categories like best solo game, best party game, light, medium and heavy game, artwork, expansion, and then game of the year. So nominations close at midnight on Sunday the 26th. So that means from Wednesday you'll have about 3 weeks to be able to complete the voting forms. And once the nominations are closed, the top 5 games in each category are listed as the official nominees. And then we turn everything over to our esteemed, in bold, esteemed judges, which are our Patreons, and they vote who they think should win each category. And we get to announce the winners at PlayCon Live in July. It's going to be very exciting. This is the first time that Lauren and I think have been involved in any awards. So, Def, are you excited?
Yeah, I mean, the announcements are what makes this, because they are always so awkward and so funny, and it's hard to explain, but you'll see what I mean. But it's very exciting to be able to engage with the community and get an idea of what people thought about the games that were released last year. And I think having a few months into 2024 gives us a bit of time, gives people a bit of time to have played more games from last year. And yeah, pretty excited to be able to vote on some of these games. And I think being involved in the past with the awards as well, it's great to be able to get some, you know, feedback back from designers or publishers for some of the games that have won. That's always a very nice touch for us to be able to reach out to some of, you know, our favorite designers or the audience's favorite games and get some feedback from them that, you know, their game has won an award. So yeah, it's an exciting process.
Def's just excited for Voidfall to have a clean sweep.
I am. I'm trying to
light
cover it
up. Light game of the year, medium game of the year, heavy game of the year.
Do you sleep with that game? Is it your pillow?
He's like too a high. Cat. Just sits in the box.
If I fits, I sits.
In terms of other awards, I'll just mention that we did mention it on the socials, but the 18th annual Golden Geek Awards, the nominations came out for that as well. This is run by Board Game Geek, and the Board Game Barbecue were nominated for the second time for the category of Best Podcast. So we were super stoked to be able to be nominated. And there are, I think, 11 other podcasts in this category. So you can vote over on BGG, and we'll put the link in socials and probably in the notes of this podcast as well, in the show notes. But if you feel that we deserve it, it would be great if you could give us a vote. We'd really appreciate it.
Very good.
So on to the sizzles.
So my sizzling game this week will be one of the oaths that I made at the start-ish of this year to play all of my coin games. For those that don't know, COIN stands for Counterinsurgency, and it's a series of games from published by GMT Games, and the original design was from Volker Runke. The first game in the series was Andean Abyss, and there's been 10 games of that series, and they've become quite a bit of classics, I think, now. They've spawned off additional series from GMT coming in the next couple of years. But my oath was to play all of the coin games that I have in my collection this year. And Falling Sky is the one I was most keen to get on the table with other people, because based on my solo plays, I thought this could potentially become my favorite of the series. Falling Sky, the full name is Falling Sky, the Gallic Revolt Against Caesar. So it's all about the historic period that Caesar had a grasp, I guess, or an occupation on Gaul, but not quite conquer all of its parts. And you have four factions. You have Caesar and the Roman Empire, and they're with Caesar and his legions. You have three Gallic tribes. Two of those are directly opposed to Rome's ruling, and one of those is kind of opposed. They don't mind working together with the Romans, and that's not uncommon in these games to have kind of informal alliances between two factions and two other factions. So the game is absolutely excellent. It has a couple of things that I really enjoy. If you haven't heard me talking about coin games before, you can go back and listen to episodes. I spoke about Old Bridges Burning. Mitch has spoken about Fire in the Lake, and there's a few more that I'll be talking about in the future. But essentially, the main mechanic in these games is always the same. It's a deck of event cards, and every round you draw the new card, and you draw the upcoming event. So you have a current and the upcoming event. And on top of these cards, you have the four faction symbols scrambled in a certain way, and that dictates the turn order for that round. And whoever is first, if they are eligible to play, then they choose what they want to do in this round. They could choose to resolve the event. They could choose to do their actions. The game calls these commands and special abilities, or they could choose to do a limited subset of that, which could be like a single command. The reason why they do that is because whatever the first eligible player chooses to do in a round sets the tone for what the second eligible player can choose. So if the first player chooses to do the event that's listed on the card, the second player can do a full turn of actions and commands and special abilities. But if the first player chooses to do a single command, then that limits the options, that takes away some options from the second eligible player. And then the players that act on this round, they're ineligible for the next turn, for the next card. So in every, if you like to call them turn, in every card, only two of the four factions will actually act. And this creates a phenomenal tension about the decision making of the eligible players, where they're trying to look at, okay, if I really want to take a turn on this card and I'm eligible to do that, but actually looking at the upcoming event, that's really good for me, or maybe that's really bad for me if somebody else takes it. And so you're trying to, well, maybe I need to pass this round to be able to take that event next turn. So even before you get into what you actually do in the game, the decision making starts from, do I want to take a turn this round? Do I want to wait? What do I want to do? Do I want to, you know, make full usage of my turn and therefore maybe open up another player to do that as well? Or do I want to take a limited turn to limit somebody else as well, to limit the next player as well? And that is a common theme across all of these games. But these are high, you know, conflict games. There is a map with regions and there's different pieces on the board and they move around, they take control of territories, they battle, they bribe, they do all sorts of things. And these are also highly thematic actions because they're driven by a set of activities on the board that you can easily translate to, you know, what the actual situation is. For instance, the pieces that the goals have, they have two sides. They have like a blank side. They're like these hexagonal cylinders. And if they're on the, they have an embossed side. If they're on an embossed side down, that means they're hidden. And so, for instance, their enemies can't battle there or they can't find them. If they act, to be able to act and do things, they have to flip up to reveal themselves, and that makes them easier to spot or easier to take out from their enemy factions. This is very sort of high-level abstracted way of I'm describing it, but yeah, the game is absolutely excellent. I think it has now become, at the moment, I think it's my favorite game in the Coin series. It is a small, relatively small map. It is very contained. It doesn't have a lot of calculations around trying to figure out what the scoring is for each faction, because the scoring, for instance, every faction in this game, like all Coin games, they mark their score in a different way. For example, the Belgic tribes, they are after control of the population, so they have to have more pieces than other factions in a space to control it, and the population of that space counts towards their score. But they also want to have their tribes out on the map, and every tribe is worth 1 point for them. While other factions, they might only be interested in how many tribes they have on the board. Caesar and his Roman Empire, they only care about how many tribes are subdued. So how many tribes in the whole of Gallic regions are not allied with one of the other three factions. Things like that. So when the maps in these games get very big and you have, you know, 25, 30, 35 spaces to manage, they can become a bit taxing in terms of, oh, hang on, those pieces moving out of that area give control to this other faction, therefore that scoring marker on the track that we're moving needs to move now, and you can forget about this and you have to recalculate the whole thing. But this game, because the map is very contained, that doesn't happen. It's really a very sort of focused game. The battle is exciting, it's quick, it has a little bit of uncertainty, but it's easy to sort of gauge which way it's likely to go, and therefore it has the tension that you'd expect from trying to attack other players. There's a bit of cooperation between players as well. The Romans, to be able to recruit new soldiers and things like that, they have to be able to reach through their supply lines, and the other factions need to be able to provide permission for that if they control the spaces in between, which doesn't happen every time. Yeah, so we had a game a couple of weeks ago of this, and everybody enjoyed it. I thought it was really excellent, and yeah, it's one of the highlights, I think, so far in the Coin series from the games I've played. This is designed by the original Coin system designer, Volker Runke, and his son, Andrew. So not all the games are designed by Volker Runke, but the first one I played in the series was All Bridges Burning, which was not designed by Volker, and that was also excellent. So yeah, that's Falling Sky, the Gallic Revolt Against Caesar. It's published by GMT Games.
Do you play this? Is this a game that can be played solo? Or
all of these games can be played solo. They have bots that you can assign to the other factions. But most of the games in the series, the bots are these big, flowchart-driven decision-making, you know, situations that they tend to optimize every single decision. And so in many times you end up spending a lot of time trying to go through their flowchart and figure out, oh, if they can control a space, they do, you know, A, B, and C. And so you start looking at the map and going, okay, can they control a space? Which one would that be? And you kind of go through the scenario. So it takes a long time, and it can be a bit taxing to run the bots. Some of the games in the series, though, they started having a better system now. And this started with volume 10 of the series, well, maybe volume 9, I can't remember now, which was Gandhi, the decolonization of British India, which has like a small deck of cards. And on the bot's turn, you draw a card and you check one requirement on the card. And if the requirement is met, then do what the card says. If not, you might do the second thing or you might draw a new card. It's a much easier system to run and much more enjoyable than the flowcharts. And I think that they're looking at applying this solo mode to both the new games in the series that are coming out now, but also to older games that have been published in the series before. For example, I know there is for a fact a solo deck coming out for Cuba Libre, which is one of the most popular games in this series.
Wow, that'll be great. Is this a case of don't have the full four, so you had three players, the fourth needs to be a bot?
You cannot play these games with parts of the faction. Yeah. So you cannot play this with two or three factions. There always has to be the full player count in the game. Now, because of the similar situation that these conflicts are portrayed, they're almost always, you know, you almost always have a similar situation of almost like an informal alliance between two and two factions. And if there's two players playing, the games almost always suggest, look, one player should play these two factions and the other player should play those two factions. So you play two factions each, but they have aligned interests in certain areas. So they're not completely, you know, it's not completely out of, it's not out of, I don't know, I guess it's not, it makes sense in a way to do that. But to be honest, I think I've played these games solo a lot, but I've played them by playing all factions rather than using the solo bots. And this is something I never thought I would do. I've spoken about this before in the past.
You're and crazy, Jeff. That's
thank you. Yeah.
Some people can't even play it. I sometimes struggle Spirit Island with two spirits. You're talking about four competing factions in a heavy coin game. That's on another level, mate. That's on another level.
It helps, though, because there's so much going on that by the time I start the turn of a new faction, I've forgotten what the previous faction was doing. So it's all good. It's fine.
Outstanding.
So, yeah, for whatever reason, I'd never do this, but for whatever reason, I've really enjoyed playing these using that method, if you like. But the solo bots do exist, and they do a decent enough job as far as I've seen so far. But by far, you know, my favorite way of playing this is with other people. That and now the group that we meet each week knows the system because we've played Cuba Libre, we've played Indian Abyss, we've played Fire in the Lake, and we've now played this. So I think at this point we're probably gonna start replaying some of these rather than exploring new ones. They can be big games, and you don't quite they can be very opaque as well. So you don't quite see the full game until you play through one of these and reach the end and go, ah. So next time, you know, I know what I have to do.
I like the idea of having simpler AI decks incorporated into these games, kind of a la Great Western Trail or Concordia, that are just very seamless AI to run.
Now, I mean, yes.
Obviously, I'm overstating because these are very complex games.
But they are.
Relatively speaking, not a huge flow chart that you've got to read 2 pages of a decision tree is more. If it's not that, I feel like it's going to get more people to try these games that yes. don't have those groups, which is great.
Yeah, 100% agree. Yeah.
If you're looking to add to your board game collection without taking out a second mortgage, then look no further than Advent Games. Dean and the team don't just sell games, they play games, they know games, they love games, just like us. And the first thing you notice when you head to adventgames.com.au is the amazing range of games. Dean and the team have worked tirelessly to make sure that every game is properly catalogued into the website. You can search by card games, dice games, family games, gateway games, solo games, and games from your favourite designers. And they don't just have games, Advent has a huge range of RPG books, game inserts, organizers, sleeves, even miniatures and scenery to make your next game night an experience to remember. Shipping is a flat $10 if you live in the Sydney metro area, $15 for the rest of Australia. And don't forget, if you sign up for their newsletter, every Friday you receive an email with the latest specials, newest arrivals, and a list of all the games that have just come back into stock. So there's no excuse for missing out on that game that you desperately want in your collection. So why not grab your next sizzling game from Advent Games? Head to adventgames.com.au now.
Lauren, I'm looking forward to hearing about Tom Vassell's number one party game of 2023. Go.
Oh, wow. You're trying to influence the vote now after my Voidfall reference?
I just wanted to say Tom Vassell.
I was able to play the same game. It's a party game designed by Wolfgang Warsch of Wavelength and Quacks of Quedlinburg fame. He's kind of delving more into the party game space now. He's got The Mind, Wavelength, same game. And they all seem to be very unique. And I think that's the one thing I'll say about this game on the outset is word association games, insofar as kind of that sphere of party games, can feel a little repetitive, right, and iterative. But he does manage to make games that feel at least a little fresh. And I think that's the best thing that I can say about the same game is it really did feel fresh. So in the same game, you have a word and all the words in the same game are man-made objects. It can't be something from nature. It's got to be something you can touch and something that's man-made. So that could be a keyboard. And you'll draw one of those cards and you'll be assigned a category. And multiple people could have the same category. And those categories could be things like material, length, frequency of use, how important it is to humanity, how high is it when it's lying down, how expensive is it, right? So all these different descriptors or qualifiers for the object. And then what you're trying to do is you're going to come up with your own word that is the same as your word from your card in your category, but none of the other categories or qualifiers. So if my word that I had was fridge and my category was price, I have to think of, okay, what's something that is the same price as a fridge, but not the same height lying when it's lying down, not the same weight, not the same material, not the same frequency of use or importance to humanity. And then I'll write down those words, that word. And it's got to be also a man-made object, can't use descriptors, numbers, adjectives, things like that. So I can't say wooden spoon or five thumbtacks, right? Things like that. And then everyone's going to one at a time rule out categories until hopefully the last one they rule out is my category. And the more they're able to do before getting to mine, the more points we're going to score. And we're just trying to collectively score as many points as we can in however many rounds. So that's the essence of the game. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. I'm just trying to think about how using your example with the fridge, and I'm trying to think of how am I going to get something that is the same price, but that's
yeah, that's, right. So two things. One, I think that if you're the kind of family that likes to have stupid debates about meaningless things, like is a ruler in fact the same length as a toilet brush versus are they not the same material because aren't they both made out of plastic?
Yeah.
Right? No, but some rulers are metal and some rulers, right? Stupid, meaningless. But if you enjoy that kind of discourse that's just a bit goofy, I think you'll like this game. I don't think that it leans itself to being funny. I don't think it's a funny party game, but I think it's really interesting. And we did have some interesting discussions. I think that depending on the mix of words you get and the categories, it could swing to being too easy, potentially. But you have options to add more categories and make it harder, things like that. But we had one where the person's word was horse-drawn carriage, and their category was complexity of construction. So what's something that's as hard,
complex to build
as a horse-drawn carriage, right? And so James wrote shipping container, and we were like, okay, they have the same intended use. They take stuff places. We were dead set. And then we're arguing, but what is a horse-drawn carriage made out of? Right? Like, silly, silly. And it was really good. It was really, really good. It was very different to, again, other party games that I've played. I've not really played something quite like it, which I think is high praise in what is a very saturated market to come up with something
that that's a good point.
And is unique.
Mm.
And I think Wolfgang Warsch is really able to do that. Wavelength is another really great example of him having been able to do that, right?
Mm.
And I don't think that it's, you know, my favorite party game of all time. I don't think I want to play it every Saturday, but definitely one that I want to keep in the rotation and definitely one that I want to try with people. I think that it probably needs more of those categories. There's not quite enough in the box, but you could create your own. Mm. The other thing is the scoring is really punishing. If you have an imperfect round once or twice, don't reach the max goal. But I guess like most party games, the scoring doesn't really matter. You're just kind of having fun playing with the components and things like that. I think also people might have, at least initially, a difficult time wrapping their head around, okay, wait, so I don't want these to be the same, but I want this to be the same. I think that maybe trip people up when you're explaining the game. But yeah, I just really, really enjoyed it. It felt really different. It felt really interesting. It allowed you to be creative. And it was, the turns were quite zippy. You know, games like So Clover, things like that, where the turns are quite pacey.
Can you play this with few and many players? Like, you know, does it work well with low and high player counts? Or
so we played it at 4.
Okay.
And it goes up to 6, but the rules also explain how you could play it at 2.
Okay.
So you can kind of play it at a wide player count. I think that it would work just as well at 3 as it would at 6.
Mm-hmm.
Can't see it being too different at those player counts. It just adjusts for how many rounds and how many words you go through and things like that.
I'm not sure how it would work at 2. That would be interesting.
Yeah, I guess you just...
My husband and I would end up in a full-on argument.
Oh, yeah. God.
Oh.
So that's the same game.
Yeah.
Really interesting, unique little party game. Quite enjoyed.
Yeah, sounds fantastic. So I'm going to talk about Arborea. Now, I actually taught this at the Brisbane Game Day, which seems like ages ago now, but anyway, it was back in March. And I was really enamored with this game. It's published by Alley Cat Games.
It's pretty.
It is, oh my God, you look at the cover, it is so pretty. And it's designed by Danny Garcia, who is the same designer as Barcelona. Now, I haven't played Barcelona, but I know of people who have played it, and I think it was sizzled recently on the podcast.
Yes.
It's meant to be a very good game. But the main thing that people talk about with this game is the artwork and whether they like it or not, I think, initially, as to whether they go ahead and then play it. But it's a worker placement Euro game where you just need to plan ahead, basically. The theme of the game is that you're a patron spirit and you're guiding your villagers to heal and grow the landscape around them, and you're going to be sending those villagers on pilgrimages, and then you're building up this little personal ecosystem in front of you. Now, that sounds a bit like a mishmash of all different things, but it does fit in with the theme. I'm probably not explaining it particularly well. So during the game, players will place workers on these action tracks, which are little pieces of cardboard. They're like a little grid of cardboard. And you're going to be placing these workers on them. And these pilgrimage tracks will either move on, they'll generally move on your turn or on other people's turns. And it will push your workers along this pilgrimage track. Now, the further along these action tracks or pilgrimage tracks that they move, the rewards are better if your workers can stay on there longer. Now, each of these little pilgrimage tracks have like little pathways that come off of it. And you get to decide if your track has moved, you get to decide whether you'd like to jump on, off, or stay on. And of course, as I said, the longer you stay on, the better it is. And so it's an interesting decision about which pathway to take and how long to stay on these tracks, and how you can go about maybe being on a track and getting the advantage of other people pushing your pilgrimage track along. It reminded me when I first played it very much like Zolkin, a bit like that, where you're going on those, you know, circular, I don't even know what you call them, circular cogs, and people can push them along further, mm-hmm. or you're having to wait and time things perfectly so that you can get off and on at the right time. Yep. So it reminds me very much of that. And so as you get off these pilgrimage tracks that are moving, and so you have to be very careful about what you're doing. The interesting thing about this game is that there's a shared, it's like a shared market, so, or a shared resource market. It's called the biome reserve. So what happens is you don't have any of your own resources. It's a shared group of resources. So on your turn, if your worker's moving down a pathway and there's a symbol for a resource, there's a particular part of the resource track that will move upwards, sort of like a resource marker that's split in half. And the top part will move up, showing that the group or the game or this resource market has gained one of that resource. So then on your turn, if you don't spend the resources that you gained, the bottom half of the resource marker will move up to meet the top one. And any victory points that it goes past, you will gain those. But what will happen is then those resources are available for other people to use. So you can actually score quite a lot of points just by getting resources but not actually even using them. And that's another thing about, you're trying to go off on these pathways, but you have to make sure that you go on the pathway and you can get the resources but use them straight away then, so other people don't use them. So timing is super important. But this shared resource track is really interesting. I don't think I've seen something similar where it measures the resources, and you can gain points just from getting resources. I don't recall a game like that, but there probably is one out there. But I thought that was really interesting. It's very point salad-y and very, very combo-y. Is that a word? I don't know. Combo-y, combolicious, combo something.
Mitch calls it combo-tastic.
Combo-tastic, that's it. But it's a lot of combos. And actually, when I took it at the taught it at the Brisbane Game Day, there was this guy who I've taught games to before. Anyway, his name's Dave Crew. I'm going to out him. Oh, my God, he's like a human computer, man. I wish I had his brain, because the way he used these combos was amazing. And once again, we were all just sort of staring in amazement at how he was able to make this game work for him. It was really wonderful. And on top of all this, on top of all these tracks and placing workers, you've got this little puzzle in front of you where you're trying to create a little reserve where you're putting creatures on that you're able to attract, and you're scoring points at the end of the game based on what's adjacent to these creatures. So you've got this little puzzle to work on as well. And on top of that, there are other end of round goals and all sorts of other things, other ways to get points. So it's just my kind of game. I love it. Now, the artwork. The artwork on the front of the box doesn't really look like what's on the board. It looks very different. It's extremely colourful. And actually, I mentioned Arborea, I think, when I was interviewing Amy and Maggie from Thinkathema. And I recall Amy saying that it was just like way too, too much in your face. You couldn't get over the artwork.
Yep.
The games that I've played and the people that I've taught it to, it hasn't been an issue at all. And certainly the iconography, because you've got these little tracks. It basically almost looks like an ant nest with all these little tracks going everywhere. But I haven't found it difficult to look at. I find it beautiful and I find it very appealing, and I haven't found the iconography a problem, but it might be a problem for some other people. I think you can, at the moment, you can only buy the Kickstarter edition, and it comes with some nice little cardboard resource trays that you can build and put in the box, which was great. And it also comes with a mini expansion, actually two mini expansions, which help a little bit with the replayability of the game. But I love it and I highly recommend it. So it's Arborea.
Very good.
What did you think, Dana, in terms of the downtime for the game?
Well, we played it four players at the game day, and it was pretty good, to be honest. I believe that I actually spoke to the players there, because I actually didn't play the game. I taught it. And I found it fascinating watching these people play, and the players there were that the time between turns was too long at all. And I think I'm quite in tune with it, because I don't like having a long time between turns. But no, we didn't find it an issue. And actually, I noticed on BGG it says it's best at 2 to 3 players, but in my experience, 4 is fine.
Yeah. And was it too long?
No.
Okay. So we're still fine. The yes. length of the game was still fine.
Yes, it was fine. No problem at all.
Great.
Mm. Very good.
So last week's question of the pod: what makes an RPG game an RPG game? And we had some responses from Facebook.
Alrighty, Roo. So from Facebook, we have Dave Dove says, to me, open world level ups and being able to solve problems with more than just hack and slash. Dialogue trees, death, magic, chance, and more should be viable options to in-game problem solving. A good RPG feels like you're affecting the world without being railroaded. Paul DeStefano says, if you can smack a character in the head with a raw trout, it's a role-playing game. Otherwise, the rules are too restrictive to play the role you may want.
There you go.
I love that.
That's it. Outstanding answer, Paul.
I'm going to use that line. I'm going to use that line somewhere. I'm going to find a way to use it.
Yeah, unless I can smack someone with a fish, I'm just not interested.
Very good. And Jonathan at Discord said, I straight away thought about two video games I enjoy a lot. The Batman Arkham Knight Trilogy and The Witcher 3. The Witcher 3 I would class as an RPG. You take on the role of being a Witcher in a society that doesn't love Witchers, and your choices have agency in terms of what happens. For me, an RPG is all about playing a role and having greater agency, or at least the illusion of that, that your choices affect the story. No matter how cool it is to play being Batman in the Arkham games, at the end of the day, the story is much more set for you and your choices don't really affect how it will end on your session or the character build for Batman. I don't fully agree with you, Adrian, he's referring to Adrian from our team, about the reasoning behind Kingdom Death not being an RPG due to having lots of characters. I think an RPG can work with multiple characters, but it has to allow for agency and attachment to each character with some proper playing of a role and character development through your choices.
I am not an RPG kind of person, so this question was certainly a difficult one for me. And when I hear the descriptions of what makes an RPG game an RPG game, the improv part scares the hell out of me. I don't think I could do that. It actually makes me nervous. But have any of you got any thoughts about the question?
I'm pretty fast and loose with what I would call an RPG. I think if there's some sort of player creative agency, I'm not as concerned with how structured the play is in so far as kind of the mechanics of it are concerned. Like a Goosebumps book, for example, right? There's a fairly, although diverging, linear path of choices, but it's still, you know, you can inject your own creative thought and role play to an extent that it informs the decisions you make. And I think because I've played a lot of kind of really weird, esoteric solo tabletop RPGs, I think there's a lot of things that I would call an RPG.
Because we're talking about the awards season, what are your predictions for the Board Game Geek light, medium, and heavy game of the year and why? Okay, I'm going to ask Lauren this time because I already know Def's answers or part of them anyway.
But so, we're talking about the Board Game Geek Awards, not the Board Game Barbecue Awards.
Yeah? Correct, Board Game Geek. So, Lauren.
I've got some thoughts.
Go.
I do think that the games that have been put on Board Game Arena, that's going to have a huge impact in how it sways things.
Agreed.
I think Sky Team's going to do really well because it's on BGA and it's in a few categories. I think that's a game that's going to do really well. I think that probably Lost Ruins of Arnak for an expansion, Dune Imperium Uprisings up for heavy game. I mean, I feel like those games will just continue to win awards as long as they're iterated upon. Totally separate to how I feel about those games, but I think that they'll probably do well. I really hope Septimar wins the Artwork Award. That game is just drop dead gorgeous.
That's beautiful.
Drop dead gorgeous. And then the other one that I think is a pretty sure bet is Earth, clinching medium game of the year. Like, that game's just so popular. What about you guys? Any kind of standout predictions?
Come on, Def.
I was just looking at the list, and I've only played two of the light game of the year nominees, Trailblazers and Gnar, and both very good games. I would probably pick. Yeah, I would probably pick Trailblazers. I just enjoy the special puzzle a lot, so that would be my preference. But obviously, I don't know how the rest of them are going to go. Medium game of the year, I agree with you, Lauren. I think Sky Team and Earth are going to do really well. In fact, if any of these two does not win this category, I will be very surprised, given on how popular they both are. Heavy game of the year, to me, some great games there. Nucleum, Kutnahora, Evacuation, the new Dune Imperium, you know, Age of Innovation, all great games, but I think they are far second to the two best games of the year for me, Voidfall and Hegemony. I would love one of these games to win it, but they do probably, you know, address a smaller audience because of their length and complexity and all of that. Yeah, so we'll see how it goes. I do think this is a category where you might actually see one of these win rather than a game that's a bit more, you know, popular perhaps, because I think that the following on these two games has been substantial and they got quite a bit of recognition already, I feel, from the wider community. So we'll see how we go.
I'm interested what you guys think about the solo category. You've got heavy hitters in there like Earth and, say, Legacy of Yu. You've also got games that come from the backing of really passionate fan bases like 20 Strong and Hoplomachus and Mr. President. So I'm just wondering what you guys think about that category.
I think there's, you know, quite a big variety there. You have Legacy of Yu that's, you know, comes from a studio that is very well loved for the games they give us, Carfield Games. You got Hoplomachus Victorum. You've got games that are already popular, like you said, Lauren Earth. And then you have like some very, very niche entries like Mr. President. I don't know how many people actually play this, but it's a massive game. So I don't know. A lot of great solo games in there. In my opinion, I think people will show some preference towards the lighter side here, because when you play solo, I do feel that that tends to be the trend. I don't know. If I was voting here, I'd probably have a, you know, hard time, because Voidfall Solo, I think, is absolutely stellar, probably the best in the market right now. Mr. President was a very unique experience. Is it enough to vote it for best solo game of the year? Hoplomachus Victorum is absolutely phenomenal. 20 Strong, Legacy of Yu, you know, all great games. Halls of Hegra, even, bridging the gap between war games and Euro games. Many, many people have enjoyed Halls of Hegra. Might manage to do the surprise. I don't know.
What about you, Dana?
I've just actually been looking at, I agree with you about Sky Team, because it's nominated for two-player, cooperative, and innovative, and medium. And I think it's going to clean up, really. In the innovative, I think Hegemony could probably do very well in that category for innovative. But yes, Sky Team is going to do extremely well. And my prediction for heavy, I'm in a bit of a different category of heavy when it comes to these. I mean, I played quite a few of these games, but I still believe that Voidfall will win. Yeah, just based on the feedback that I've seen online, etc. It's pretty much Def, like Def 2.0 every time.
Very good.
So we'd love to hear your thoughts about who you would like to see win the categories for light, medium, and heavy game of the year and why. So if you'd like to support the podcast, you can always go to patreon.com/boardgamebarbecue. And get access to exclusive podcast episodes that we record just for our Patreons. There are plenty of ways to support the podcast without donating. And the easiest way to do it is to tell your friends and spread the word about our podcast. You can also go to Apple Podcasts or Spotify and leave a review, a 5-star review preferably. You can also get involved in the Board Game Barbecue community by joining our Facebook community on X and Instagram or on YouTube. Also, there's a large Discord community that you can get involved in, and all the links are in the show notes. So it's come to the time where we swear an oath and see whether we've been doing what we're supposed to be doing since the last time we were on the podcast. Have you been doing what you're meant to be doing, Def?
I have this time. My oath was, like I said at the start, to play more of my coin games. So I played Falling Sky. Another pending oath was to play 21 Moon on the table, which I actually did this week. It's probably going to be my next sizzle. And I kind of also swore to play more Inventions because I knew that was going to happen. So I've played it like 5 times in the last 6 days. So I've done a bit of work. So I'm happy with that. Now, in terms of a new oath, I want to swear a new oath about a game I'm looking very forward to play, but I don't know if it's going to be here on time, but I will swear that oath anyway. And that is to play A Chest of Robin Hood, which is a new title from GMT Games that is about to ship next week. So I'm hoping it will be here on time for me to play it. So that's my new oath.
Lauren.
Nice. Well, I was, able to play the same game. Not as many reps as Def in terms of games, but managed to get that in. My new oath is one, Def, that I think you're going to be happy with, because you recently posted about a list of games that you were interested in purchasing. And my new oath was on your list.
Oh.
And that is Ginkopolis.
Oh, yes, please.
Is a game that I purchased on a whim because I've just seen lots of talk about it. It seems really interesting, really different. Still in shrink, but I'm going to tear it open, get it to the table before the next time I'm on the pod, which I think is very soon. So we'll see how that goes.
Well, it's on Board Game Arena as well. So if you need help, I can assist with this.
Any excuse. But yeah, so my new oath is to play Ginkopolis.
My old oath was, well, not my old oath, my oath was to play Beyond the Sun, because I'm not sure if you know, Lauren, but I'm doing this thing where I pick a Patreon and then I play a game from their top 10. So Megan Moore, one of our Patreons, is I chose her number one game, which was Beyond the Sun. Now, I scraped in with barely time to spare. I played it this morning and on BGA. I could not get a physical copy played, but Meg was very kind enough to teach me Beyond the Sun on BGA. I'm not sure if you know, but apparently it's called Tech Tree, the board game. And
so good.
And, well, number one, I was extremely impressed that Megs was able to teach me this game, which was, when you look at it on a screen, on a computer screen, it looks very complicated. So I was very impressed that she was able to actually teach me on BGA. But secondly, I actually really enjoyed it. The theme, you know, space is not the usual sort of theme that I would play, but I really enjoyed the tech tree aspect of it. And I just thought it was a really interesting game. I have never played what I would describe as a tech tree game before. So it was really fascinating to me. And once again, I was pleased that afterwards I would have liked to have jumped on and played another game of it. So I hope to be able to do that. But yes, so I did play it. So I managed to get that one in. And my next oath, I've chosen Ben Todd, who we all know from Brisbane. And in his top 10 is the Red Dragon Inn. So I hopefully will play that before the next time I'm on the podcast.
It's a drinking game, Dana.
That's really not good for me being a non-drinker. Although I could be convinced to start again, maybe. Maybe one day. So that's it. That's the end of the pod. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you
so much, guys.
And we'll see you next time.
Cheers.
Take care. Bye. New question, here we go.
Are you editing this?
I am editing it. Can't even say the words.
Sorry.
It's late, lads.